From WBUR Boston, I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. For 8 years, Nancy Soderbergh served as a senior foreign policy advisor in the Clinton White House and the United Nations. In her new book, The Superpower Myth, she has a sharp critique of the Bush administration's first 4 years, but she says America may be on the verge of a second-term shift from enforcer to persuader once again. Tonight on Point, Nancy Soderbergh on The Superpower Myth and 4 more years of foreign policy from the Bush White House. But first, we turn to Washington. The president has returned now from his 5-day European tour after meetings with EU and NATO officials in Belgium, Germany, and Slovakia. The goal was a healing of transatlantic rifts caused by the invasion of Iraq. John Dickerson, White House correspondent for Time magazine, was with the president in Europe. I asked him if the White House is now describing the fence-mending trip as mission accomplished.
Well, they are. Of course, they always say mission accomplished after these trips. And it's when you hear them talk about fence mending, this is about the fourth or fifth fence mending trip the president has been on since he was first elected. His relationship with Europe has always been tricky, and so he's always had to mend fences. But having said that, there were some accomplishments here, and there was a difference in tone, both because the president was listening a little bit more and because the Europeans seemed to be embracing him a little bit more.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about some specifics in just a minute, but do you get the sense that this trip was more than window dressing, that it might in fact signal a real change in direction for the administration toward perhaps closer partnerships again with Europe and Russia?
It remains to be seen. There were certainly some things that were different. One is that the president really does believe that now is the time for diplomacy. He's done the shock and awe, and now there's a lot more that can be done on the areas of interest and important areas of U.S. national security that can be done through a kind of softer power, through diplomacy, negotiation, not so much through military force. Now, he would have said that long before September 11th, but nevertheless, this is more what's in the forefront of his mind. And also, troops are stretched too thin, and frankly, his military options have been pared down a little bit. So there is a learning curve that senior advisors at the White House will talk about. And the president, even in an amazing admission during this trip, he said, you know, sometimes because of my worldview after 9/11, we talk past each other, talking about the U.S.-Atlantic relationship. And he said, I'm sometimes to blame for that. Well, that's something you just don't hear from this president here domestically, is him taking blame for a situation that's gone a little bit sour. So these were the kinds of signals that suggested to some Europeans that there was a difference in tone here.
Well, let's talk about some of those major issues that were on the table before this trip began. One, of course, weapon sales to China, nuclear issues with Iran, creeping totalitarianism in Russia, NATO involvement in Iraq. Where were the areas of major progress in the past week?
They got an agreement for more NATO activity and training Iraqi security forces, and even got the French on board with that, although in a very, very tiny way. There were also some agreements with the Russians on nuclear weapons and on shoulder-fired missiles. And there was even a little bit of interesting daylight on the Iran question. Coming over on Air Force One, senior advisors to the president were very discouraging in terms of any kind of negotiating with Iran or any kind of inducements that might be used to get Iran to back off of its uranium enrichment. Then after the meetings, the president and his national security advisor, Stephen Hadley, suggested that maybe, well, they said that the president had heard from European leaders and was going to think about it. Again, this is something that is different. A couple of years ago, you could have seen the president say, look, we're not going to reward bad behavior, and sort of stopped it at that. And now he's suggesting, well, maybe there might be a way to negotiate with Iran or provide some kind of inducements to stop their nuclear program. So that's still all very much up in the air, but even suggesting that these inducements might be used was new. And then finally, on the China trade question, that seems to be something where the president is very skeptical about European promises that weapons that would go to China wouldn't change the security balance in the region.
As you went with the president from place to place, what was your sense of how he was being received by both people in the street and how this was playing in the European press?
It's hard to say, in part because, there were the regular protests that attend his visits. They were a little less virulent than they have been in the past. Certainly, we didn't hear so much from European leaders in opposition. There was a kind of joint agreement, not formal, but certainly pervasive, that really everybody would just not talk about Iraq and the Iraq war. It felt very much like everybody had kind of moved past that, and since that had energized so many of the protests and so many of the complaints about U.S. foreign policy and the president's previous missions to Europe, having that be kind of agreed upon, at least at the official level, that people wouldn't talk too much about it, lowered the boil. And the press was kind of mixed, as it always is. I mean, there was plenty of negative press about the president's visit, but there were also enough voices that heard his keynote speech in his first day that he was there, in which he talked about a new era of cooperation, and who basically people said, this is what we like to hear, and everybody kind of agreed that it'll really, the devil will be in the details, to use the old cliche.
What happens next? Are there definitive next steps that were talked about this trip, or was the point simply to shake some hands, smile, make it sound as if the United States really is interested now in what Europe has to say?
Well, I guess the next steps will be whatever the president agrees to in terms of on Iran. Will the United States enter into the negotiations? Will the United States support any kind of inducement that would get Iran to stop its uranium enrichment? There will be proposals by European Union for relaxing the arms embargo, and the president and Congress will have to decide whether those protocols are too loose. And then there's the no definitive deadlines, but there's this open question about the progress of democracy in Russia. And there was a very tense press conference yesterday with the president and President Putin, in which we had a little seminar on freedom of the press, and it's very clear lit that the Russian president doesn't like a lot of lecturing from the outside, and thinks pretty much that President Bush has done a few things domestically to curb terrorism that are sort of paralleling what Putin thinks he's doing in his own country. And so that was a pretty tense exchange yesterday, and we'll see whether the president's rather extensive remarks to President Putin in private about the sort of state of democracy in Russia, whether they had any effect at all.
Well, John Dickerson, welcome back, and thanks so much for the update.
Sure, thank you.
John Dickerson is White House correspondent for Time magazine. He spoke with me from Washington. Foreign policy adviser Nancy Soderberg was there from Bill Clinton's first term right to the end of his second. She understands the challenges of crafting a workable foreign policy plan for the Oval Office and has some advice for her successors. Avoid the superpower myth. The Bush administration fell victim to it in the first term, she says, but can still embrace a more multilateral approach in its second. The Bush tour of Europe was a start, she says. Now the administration must choose whether to cling to the myth or break free of it. You can join the conversation. Do you believe that the Bush administration has bought into the superpower myth? And do you see U.S. foreign policy changing over the next 4 years or continuing on with the status quo? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining me now from New York is Nancy Soderberg, senior foreign policy advisor to Bill Clinton. From 1993 to 96, she was the third-ranking official at the National Security Council, and from 1997 to 2001, served as U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. Now a vice president at the International Crisis Group, her new book is The Superpower Myth, The Use and Misuse of American Might. Welcome, Nancy Soderberg.
Good evening. Thanks for having me.
I want to start with something that you wrote on the eve of Bush's second inaugural in January. You suggested that the administration was entirely too focused on the superpower myth, and you worried at the time that it was just making the wrong choices about how to make America safe. Well, you know, what a difference a month makes, because this latest swing through Europe seems to have followed your blueprint. So what are you thinking now?
Well, I'd like to say they followed my blueprint. I read my book and said, the lightning struck and have decided to change course. But I really think what's happened is they pursued the myth that as the lone superpower, they could bend the world to its will, primarily on its own. And it really hasn't worked. While they'll never admit it, they are slowly changing course. Now, it's only a month into the second term, so we have to see whether the new rhetoric really turns into a second term conversion. But I think it's hopeful that they will become, once again, put America as their persuader, not just enforcer. And the Europe trip that the president has just completed could well be the first step in that direction. I hope it is.
How do you account for it? Is it perhaps the learning curve that we heard about a few moments ago? You know, it certainly was interesting to hear Bush for the first time saying that perhaps he was to blame.
Well, you know, reality has an annoying way of slipping into your daily life. And I think they've found that the world is not going to go along with them on Iraq, so we're stuck with that one on our own. They're realizing that they can't just stand up to North Korea and Iran on their own. And they're realizing that they're having trouble promoting democracy around the world and that they need to build coalitions to affect change and that they just can't do it on their own.
Well, some might wonder, though, Nancy, you know, what's wrong with behaving like a superpower? We're the only
one
there is.
Well, we are a superpower. We should behave as a superpower. And one of the myths is that the superpower doesn't need friends and allies in order to change the world in our way. The difference between the way a superpower should be used and the way it has been used is that the Bush administration has used the superpower primarily to enforce its will, and it really has not worked. What we need to do is return the superpower to the world's chief persuader through our ideas so that we inspire people, through our strong political will, and at times through our military might. But we cannot just do it on our own.
Well, we're going to continue in just a moment. We're talking this hour about the superpower myth and foreign policy in the second Bush term. We're asking, do you see a second-term shift from the White House? Is America embracing the role of persuader rather than enforcer once again? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harris, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This week concludes President Bush's European tour, which the White House is heralding as a success. Does Bush's trip make you more optimistic that the U.S. will take a more multilateral approach over the next 4 years, or do you see an administration still wedded to the superpower myth? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And with me from New York is Nancy Soderberg, a senior national security advisor in the Clinton administration, now a vice president at the International Crisis Group. Her new book is The Superpower Myth: The Use and Misuse of American Might. Nancy, I thought it might be helpful if we could take a look at some of the specific issues and new opportunities as you see them in foreign policy now. Let's start with Iraq, post-war Iraq.
Well, Iraq is the one area that I don't think is going to change much. It's really too late to do much different in Iraq. I think it is what it is. History will debate for some time whether it was worth the American investment, which in the end will have turned out to be hundreds of billions of dollars, and most likely we'll end up losing as many soldiers in Iraq as we did on that tragic day on September 11th. But we're there now, and we have no choice other than to make it work. And to make it work, it means rebuilding Iraq, getting those lights back on, and most importantly, setting up a security system, a security force that can take over from the U.S. Army. That's going to take several years, so we are there for the foreseeable future in more or less the same numbers. I do think it will work. I think in the end the Iraqis will be far better off with the government that will leave behind than they were under the decades of Saddam Hussein. Whether they can transfer that into all the promises of reform in the Arab world and democracy is another issue. But I think Iraq itself, it's going to look a lot like it does right now for the next few years.
Well, what about that, the huge issue of reform in the Arab world? Are things now poised to make some progress there or no?
I think it's quite possible that the second term of the Bush administration could have very dramatic progress on the Middle East. Arab reform is certainly high up on the agenda, and it will be impacted by what kind of progress, first and foremost, is achievable on the Israeli-Arab conflict. And there, I think you've got the best hope in many years for real progress. You have a new Palestinian leadership that's emerged that seems to be doing all the right things. So for the first time in some time, the Israelis have a true partner there. Sharon may turn out to be the next Nixon who goes to China, who actually makes peace with the Palestinians. We'll see. I think the key to success in this new equation is whether the Bush administration will get off the sidelines that it sat on for the last 4 years, where it's really, truly disengaged from the region, and engage and become a catalyst in the search for peace. If it's it's also quite interesting that Condoleezza Rice has chosen not to appoint a special envoy. She is the envoy, and I think that's a good sign. She will be personally engaged in this, will have the ear of the president. So I think you see dramatic hope there. You could also see it in the Syrian-Israeli relationship. The Syrians made an enormous mistake last week when they decided to go back to the old car bomb days of the 70s and 80s and it's not been proven yet that the Syrians have actually done it, but I think the suspicions are high, and the U.S. did withdraw its ambassador there, a step that they would not do lightly. They decided to murder the former prime minister of Lebanon on the streets of downtown Beirut. Now, that's likely to backlash against the current leadership in Damascus. And so I think they're already talking about withdrawing their troops from Lebanon. I think you may well see a shift in the old guard out of power there and perhaps some movement there. All of that will help promote reform in the Arab world.
How significant is it, do you think? You referred to Condi Rice now being in charge of Middle East peace. Wonderful if you succeed. Double-edged sword, though, because nobody really has been able to succeed for very long so far.
There's a lot of Secretary of States littered on the highway to peace in the Middle East and lots of envoys. And I think, though, that they really don't have a choice other than to engage. The fact that they have disengaged for the last 4 years has been a catalyst for lessening the process. There's this overused analogy in peace processes that it's like a bicycle. You have to keep moving forward or it falls over. And while I don't think we could have had a dramatic breakthrough in the last 4 years of Arafat's life, we could have done more to keep it moving. And now I think what will happen is they'll engage and they will make some progress. Whether she'll get a peace agreement between Israel and all its neighbors may not be achievable in the next 4 years, but I think serious progress will be. I think the tougher areas is your earlier question on Arab reform. The Bush administration put forward an Arab reform plan in 2003, but this was when they were still in the superpower myth phase. They forgot to consult with any real Arab governments on it, basically put it out with no consultation, and not surprisingly, the Arabs rejected it and it went nowhere. They need to revive that, begin to engage the Arab leadership, try and move things forward. That is also going to take some time. This is a generational shift. You have to re-educate a new generation of Arab leaders. So that's going to be a long-term process that you won't see dramatic breakthroughs. I think we could make more immediate progress in trying to reform the education system and make it more secular and try and get some of the government-sponsored anti-American, anti-Semitic rhetoric on the airwaves and in the print newspapers and on television to cease, and that slowly that will change.
Nancy Soderberg, not surprisingly, a lot of people want to talk to you. Let's go to our phone lines to Salem, Massachusetts first, where Mark is joining us. Hello, Mark.
Oh, hello, and thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to respectfully disagree with your guest that I don't think that Bush has indulged in the superpower myth. From where I stand anyway, I see that he made an enormous effort both to garner the UN, both in sending Colin Powell over to Africa to get the votes in the Security Council. It's only when that absolutely failed that they finally decided to go in without that specific Security Council vote. And I don't specifically think that there's a change in policy. I think Saddam Hussein was their most important goal, and I think having accomplished the overthrow of Saddam Hussein, they are willing to work more with the other powers in terms of the less important goals like Iran and Syria, because I do think fundamentally they do want to work with other powers as much as possible. But being the superpower, we have to have a leadership role.
Mark, thanks for the call.
Well, I have a number of friends that live in Salem, so I'm a big fan of Salem, Massachusetts. I think I would challenge you on a couple of points. First of all, they did not work with the international community very long on Iraq. They went to the UN in November and got a very good resolution, but then pushed the whole international community aside just a few months later. You have to look at why we went into Iraq. We went into Iraq primarily because we believed there were weapons of mass destruction that immediately and dramatically threatened the United States. I think that's been resoundingly proven to have been false. Had they waited a little bit, would that have become clear? I think probably so. So I think that's a debate that you need to look at in a different perspective of why did we go in and was that the right decision and were we really threatened? I agree with you that the administration came to office with Iraq as their number one concern, but I'm not sure that that was the number one threat to Americans in the early years of their first term. I would argue that they did not pay enough attention to the al-Qaeda threat. I think Richard Clark has very well detailed that in his book. And more importantly, not more importantly, but it's important to remember that they also have let the nonproliferation issue boil in a way that I would consider irresponsible. When they took office, North Korea probably had one or two nuclear weapons. They now probably have 6 to 8. Iran has made progress towards a nuclear weapon. I don't really like the idea that North Korea and Iran are there churning out nuclear weapons with absolutely no real reaction from the United States. Now, I think that's beginning to change. They're going to have to make a deal with North Korea, and they're working to bring the allies along on their policy on Iran. If you look at the efforts to control nuclear weapons around the world, they have rejected every international effort to do that, the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, the Chemical Weapons Ban, the Biological Weapons Ban. All of those have been shifted aside. They put a man in charge of arms control at the State Department who fundamentally does not believe in arms control. All of those things have made America less safe. Their anti-Americanism has spiked. I mean, their anti-rest of the world has spiked anti-Americanism to unprecedented levels. 7 out of 8 Muslim countries today consider the United States to be a threat to them. More than half of most European people do not believe that the United States is acting in their interest. And that's dangerous. We need to be able to restore America to a source of inspiration for the world so they follow us and emulate our democratic values other than the reverse.
Nancy, I want to bring Peter Brooks into the conversation now. He's joining us from Washington. He is a senior fellow for national security affairs and director of the Asian Studies Center at the Heritage Foundation. Peter, welcome to you.
Thank you.
You made a very interesting point in an article a few days ago about the difference between Reagan's first term and his second. You know, we've often heard of W as the ideological son of Reagan. Do you see the same kind of shift in Bush administration policy happening here?
Well, it's certainly a possibility. This was in my New York Post article from Monday about the president's visit. Reagan had a tough time in his first term, but he turned it around, and I think that the Europeans were hoping for something more like Reagan II than Bush I this time around. They felt that Reagan was willing to compromise, and that's one of the reasons they were able to end up withdrawing, the Soviets were able to end up withdrawing 20 or plus divisions from Eastern Europe. But I think, you know, there was going to have to be compromise on both sides. I think it was a successful visit. I think the president accomplished a lot. It would be hard to accomplish a tremendous amount in such a short visit, but I think it was very important that he went, and I think there's been some opportunities for coordination and consultation on both sides on some very important issues.
And Peter, where do you think are the issues, or what are the issues where you think the administration could or should still hold the line?
Well, Iran is something I'm very concerned about. I mean, I think that we should support the Europeans' diplomatic efforts, but I think that's going to fall short. And I think we're going to have to take more stronger efforts. And that doesn't mean necessarily military action, but I think, you know, maybe taking it to the UN Security Council for punitive economic sanctions is one thing. But I think we should let the Europeans run that. Another thing that we're out of sorts on is the EU arms embargo on China. This is very troubling. We both put an arms embargo on China in 1989 after the Tiananmen Square incident, where about 3,000 democracy protesters were killed. And they want to lift that arms embargo. We have obligations in the Pacific. We are we are basically responsible for, in a lot of ways, for security in the Pacific. The Europeans have no responsibilities, and they're talking about lifting the arms embargo, which could allow high technology or weapons to flow to China, whose military is building very rapidly, and could destabilize stabilize the Taiwan Strait. As you know, China considers Taiwan to be a renegade province, and it certainly could be destabilizing. The Japanese are also very nervous about it. In fact, for the first time ever, they mentioned the Taiwan Strait in their new national defense policy paper. So there's a couple of things along those lines. Also, NATO, I would say. NATO is very important to us, and I think that any European defense force should be part of NATO. There shouldn't be a separate operational or planning cell, and the French and the Germans are both pushing that.
Nancy, I want to give you a chance to jump in here and perhaps respond to Peter.
Yeah, I mean, I think actually I would agree with most of what Peter's saying, but if you listen to what he's saying, in each case, it's the United States having tried to go it alone and failed. I actually agree with the Bush administration's policy towards Iran, which is that we cannot tolerate an Iranian nuclear program. Their solution is to send it to the Security Council and get sanctions. Well, you can send it to the Security Council, but unless the other members of the Security Council go along, nothing's going to happen. It's an empty threat unless the key countries, and in this case it's France, Britain, Germany, and Russia, all agree to impose tough sanctions. And I think they have not been willing to go along with the administration over the last 4 years. I think they're beginning to think more seriously about it. You also had some loose talk about a military strike against Iran. Vice President Cheney openly referred to the possibility that Israel might take care of that problem, as they did with Iraq in 1981. I think that people who know the situation believe that is not a particularly realistic solution at this stage. So in each of the cases that Peter mentioned, the only way we're going to get what we want is to persuade others to come along with us. These are not issues that a superpower, as the myth that they've been living on for the last 4 years would have you believe, can solve it on their own.
Jenny's joining us now on the line from Oxford, North Carolina. Hi, Jenny. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you. I'm concerned that this administration very much is in the superpower position, and that there's also this kind of divine entitlement, the religious elements that have been part of the conversation, certainly part of the campaign, kind of contributing to an overconfidence. For example, I remember hearing President Bush on the TV ensuring all of us that we would be in and out of Iraq in 3 to 6 weeks. And, of course, I knew that wasn't going to happen, but he apparently didn't. And I think this is this is intrinsic to their stance. It's a poor position for estimating this war and other activities. I don't feel I remember a week before we found the ship from Korea with the nuclear arms, I heard President Bush on the radio threatening to use radioactive weapons if necessary against Iraq. And with this kind of lack of wisdom and diplomacy, we've really been set up as a superpower in a very negative way. Nobody is going to come to us about their nuclear weapons when we're threatening their neighbors with them.
Okay, Jenny, I think we have your point. Let me put that to Peter.
Well, she brings up a lot of different points there. It's hard to guess which one is the one I should address. I mean, I think it's somewhat unfair, whether you're talking about President Bush or President Clinton or any president, to expect them to be able to foretell the future. I mean, you make decisions, policy decisions, and you have to stick. You know, you kind of have to stick with them, and it's incumbent upon you to lay things out as you see it for the American people. I mean, the Clinton administration had their share of problems. I mean, they had an agreement with North Korea on nuclear weapons, and it turned out for 4 of the 8 years. We're in the agreement where we transferred millions of dollars of energy aid to North Korea, that North Korea was cheating. And if we had continued probably along the same path with North Korea as the Clinton administration had, North Korea may have a uranium bomb instead of a plutonium bomb. The other thing is Osama bin Laden. Osama bin Laden attacked the United States for the first time in 1993. Now, that was certainly early on in the Clinton administration, and I don't think we know as much about Osama bin Laden then as we do now.
But are you referring to the first World Trade Center bombing?
Yeah, the first World Trade Center bombing. This was an al-Qaeda operation, and a number of people were killed, obviously not the same number as in 2001. But, I mean, this was a gathering storm. There were other attacks that the administration – the Clinton administration perhaps should have dealt with. But, I mean, these people are all well-intentioned. Sometimes they get it right, sometimes they get it wrong, but I don't think it's fair to say, I mean, you have to look back at history and all of our presidents. It's a very difficult job. It's very, and basically you're asking people to predict the future on some of these things, but they're using their best judgment and hopefully, and obviously I would think in all cases, in what they see is the best interest of the United States.
All right. Well, Peter Brooks, thank you so much for joining us and for giving us your point of view. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Peter Brooks is Senior Fellow for National Security Affairs and Director of the Asian Studies Center at the Heritage Foundation. And stay with us. We're going to be taking a brief break, and then we'll be back to talk more about the future of American foreign policy over the next 4 years and in the 21st century with top Clinton administration advisor Nancy Soderbergh. What's the foreign policy shift you might like to see from the Bush White House? On Iran and Iraq, on China and North Korea? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking tonight about America's foreign policy and the path ahead for the Bush administration. Given the experience of the past 4 years, what has President Bush learned? Is the superpower myth still with us, or is it fading? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And with me from New York is Nancy Soderbergh, a senior national security advisor in the Clinton administration, author of a new book, The Superpower Myth, The Use and Misuse of American Might. And in your book, Nancy, you mentioned that the Bush administration began with what you describe as the ABC rule, anything but Clinton. Wondering, how did that complicate matters for the new Bush team? And also, on a personal level, how frustrating is that for someone like you to have worked on certain policies for years and then just see them completely changed?
Well, it's very frustrating. I mean, one of the things I try and do in the book is explain what it's like to be a normal person in extraordinary circumstances. You know, one day you're working on President Clinton's campaign in the back of a bus, and then several months later you're sitting on Air Force One or in the Situation Room, and what that's like. And you invest your personal, you know, life in these things. So to see it all unravel is quite painful. But I also think history has a certain rhythm, so I think the pendulum is likely to swing back, and that's why I'm hopeful that the second term will actually do that. I think the anything but Clinton, the ABC approach of the Bush administration, had a couple of very dangerous impacts. First and foremost was the focus on terrorism. One of the things that the transition team emphasized to the president has, and his team, is the real threat from Al-Qaeda and terrorism. It was really a huge focus of the Clinton administration. And this is a team that came into office with really the kind of tail end of the Cold War mentality, and it could really only focus on threats from states. And I think that helped persuade them to focus on China and Iraq as opposed to the threat from terrorism. The other is North Korea. Peter Brooks, who's just left us, spoke about the cheating of the North Koreans and the fact that they started up a nuclear weapons program while Clinton was still in office. And I think it's important for your listeners to understand what the deal in North Korea is. Clinton managed to negotiate a deal with the North Koreans which stopped their plutonium program, and they would have had many nuclear bombs from that program had that agreement not existed. And people also forget that we got the Asians to pay for it. It didn't really cost us anywhere near the amount it cost the Asians. They did start cheating in 1998 with a second longer-term uranium program that was discovered in 2001. And I think you've got to look at the North Koreans as, of course they're going to cheat. They're always going to cheat. It's a question of, can you slow it down? Can you contain it and control it until that regime falls? And what's happened is, for the last 4 years, we've subcontracted our negotiations to China, and we've not really put a workable plan on the table. So the North Koreans have just gotten more and more frenetic, churning out more and more nuclear weapons, and I consider that irresponsible. I also don't really want my policies and negotiations subcontracted to China. They should be involved, but they shouldn't be making the decisions we should be. And I think you'll see that policy beginning to shift back towards a more reasonable deal, and the deal they'll ultimately make in North Korea will look a lot like the one that President Clinton made, because in government there's often no good options and you have to pick the least unattractive option available, and that in this case is negotiating with a North Korea that will always try and cheat.
To Madison, Wisconsin now, Dilip is joining us. Hello, Dilip, and what do you think of all this?
Thanks for taking my call. I fundamentally disagree with your guest, and I know that Peter is not on the line, but here is my basic point, that America has, and the West, but primarily America, has to atone for their sins on the Third World. They have, America and Soviet Union and the West, have used the Third World as their playground. I am a U.S. citizen who moved over here from Asia 35 years ago, and America is telling the rest of the world, we can continue to build nuclear weapons and modernize them as fast as we can, but the rest of the world cannot develop nuclear weapons. They should be defenseless at our mercy, that everything is on the table whenever they dictate anything they want, including the nuclear option, and you have to swallow it.
And so is your point, Dilip, that everyone should be part of the nuclear club, or that the U.S. just shouldn't be dictating that?
Well, the point is America needs to start reducing its own research. It should stop all of its own research, and it should start getting rid of its own weapons.
All right, Dilip, thank you. Let's put that to Nancy.
I actually agree on the fact that the United States needs to stop talking about developing new nuclear weapons. There's a big talk about trying to come up with a bunker buster nuclear weapon and other uses of nuclear weapons. And I think it's time to realize that the world is safer without nuclear weapons than with them. In fact, today, the caller said he was from Asia, the most dangerous place on Earth right now, I would argue, is between India and Pakistan. They're both nuclear armed. They are not submitting to the appropriate inspections. And it's a very volatile area. We almost had a nuclear war there in 1999, and it could happen again.
Dilip, thanks so much for the call. We've been talking about some of the Clinton administration foreign policy successes. Nancy, it seems only fair to ask what your greatest regret might be. You certainly write eloquently about Rwanda.
Yes, what I try and do in the book is go through the difficult decisions of the early years of the Clinton administration and try and explain why it was so difficult to get it right. In hindsight, it's easy to see we should have moved more quickly on Bosnia and done more on Rwanda. And I try and take the readers into the Situation Room and to understand, get them to understand exactly what's involved in some of these decisions where you don't have perfect information, you don't really know what's going on, you got a lot of other stuff going on at the same time. The hardest chapter for me to write was the one on Rwanda, because all of us who were involved in that at the time, and I was at the White House at the time, wish we had done more. And I think in hindsight, it's clear we should have done a lot more to try and stop the killing, tried to save lives where we could, and to try and do more since then to try and stop any potential mass killings and genocides like that. What happened in the Rwanda case is we were simply not prepared to intervene and put our troops there. That was never on the table. We didn't know exactly what was going on until about half the people had died. Once we realized the scale, we should have moved more quickly. But what I try and argue is that the international community, the United States and the European countries, are not prepared to send their troops into the middle of a genocide to stop it. And I think that's reprehensible, but I think it's important for policymakers to recognize that they're not willing to do it. And if you look today at what's happening in Darfur, in Sudan, where 300,000 people have died in the last 2 years, mm-hmm. and 10,000 a month are still dying, we know what's going on. And the U.S. and Europeans are not willing to put their troops on the ground. Now, the solution to this, I would argue, is to try and develop regional capacities in Africa who can act more quickly. If you look at the world, we and the Europeans are willing to intervene in Europe, although it took us almost 3 years to do it in the Balkans. The Australians are willing to intervene in East Timor. The Latins can take care of themselves. And the Africans lack the capability to do so. And I think we have a deep responsibility to do more to help them. And I would argue it should be a job of NATO's to train those forces so that you have a regional force that understands the risk and is willing to put their own troops on the ground very quickly.
I also want to ask about something that you write about that happened in August of 2003. You lost a friend and a colleague when the UN mission in Baghdad was bombed. It's pretty clear who you hold accountable for that loss, indirectly, if not directly. And is that one of the most disquieting things that you think about going forward, you know, the blue hats now being targeted as well?
Well, I think for your readers, you're referring to Sergio Vieira de Mello, who is the UN's probably one of the most dynamic, successful UN public servants anyway, widely assumed to have been the next Secretary General. And he was sent to Iraq by the Secretary General to run the UN operation there and was killed along with 21 others in a car bomb, many of whom those of us here in New York who work closely with the UN knew, and I considered Sergio a friend. And it's devastating when that happens. You can't quite believe it. I still think he's going to come bounding through the doors of the UN at some point. And I think it's important to recognize that those of us who advocate interventions around, you have to get it right. And the UN did not get it right in deploying the troops to Iraq. It wasn't safe. It wasn't secure. They didn't do enough to protect them. And I think it reinforces.
But they thought it wasn't necessary, right? I mean, they thought they were the UN. They're not going to be targets.
Exactly. And I know that that weighs heavily on the Secretary General's conscience and others at the UN. The UN thought that its blue flag protected it from attack. They felt they were neutral. No one would attack them. And the situation in Iraq was very different. Those days are over. The UN is very much into the protection mode right now. If you notice, they would not go back to Iraq, despite President Bush's strong push for them to do so. They're very conscious of the need to protect their people. And it's unfortunate, but it's the reality of living in the 21st century with the threat of terrorism.
Just in the little bit of time we have left, you've written that you still believe the world will follow the United States if it does the right thing. It strikes me that the difficulty here is the right thing is often in the eye of the beholder, isn't it?
I think that you can tell whether you get it right and whether others start to follow you or not. And so it may be I may have a view of what's right, but what will prove whether it's right is whether the rest of the world begins to sign up to our things. No one's signing up to the deal in Iraq because nobody thinks it was the right thing to do. Well, the Bush administration talks about a lot of allies. The truth is that 90% of the troops on the ground are American. And I think that when we start beginning to convince the Europeans to go along with us in a tougher situation in Iran, when we try and begin to build international coalitions to stand up to terrorists, to stand up to nonproliferators, I argue that the policy the administration must follow is called tough engagement. We need to re-engage in the world, but we have to gather a world coalition against terrorism and nonproliferation with zero tolerance. Once that starts happening, we'll know we have got it right.
Ambassador Nancy Soderberg, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Nancy's book is The Superpower Myth, The Use and Misuse of American Might. You can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on Forums. In just a moment, the real prizes being given away at this weekend's Academy Awards. This is On Point. The 77th Annual Academy Awards airs this weekend. Movie industry winners won't be the only ones taking home Oscar gold on Sunday night. In fact, just about every star who attends the Oscars or the pre- and after parties gets a thank-you basket filled with designer luxury goodies. Everything from Kay Unger cashmere pajama bottoms to diamond-studded Victoria's Secret lace panties that retail for $10,000. For companies giving away the goodies, there's the shot at massive amounts of free press if the celebrities wear or use the items. For the celebs, well, what's another pair of diamond-studded underwear for Hollywood A-listers? In this radio diary, L.A. Times pop culture and Hollywood writer Leslie Gornstein does a little digging into the Oscar gift bag.
This is going to the performers and presenters at Sunday's Academy Awards, and this is the official gift basket. This is the official thank you. We're looking at a Krupp's kitchen set, not just a coffee maker. It also includes a toaster, an electric kettle, and a year's supply of coffee and tea. That's $700. A two-night stay at the Carlisle Hotel in New York, which is $2,300. A three-night stay for two, plus a personal butler at the St. Regis Monarch Beach Resort and Spa in Dana Point, California, which is south of Los Angeles, for $5,900. That's what a normal person would pay for that. An unlimited day of services at a day resort, an assortment of olive oil, cashmere pajama bottoms, a dinner party at any Morton Steakhouse, and this is just the tip of the iceberg, a red leather case filled with Shu Uemura cosmetics, including mink eyelashes, and that's worth $600. The list goes on and on and on. There's usually a bidding war when it comes to actually getting stuff in the Oscar gift basket, but when it comes to just setting up a suite, there's really nothing to it. You just book it a year in advance, set it up, let the press know what's going on, let the publicist know what's going on, and then you just start your begging. You just call all the publicists and say, look, I would really like it if Nicole Kidman showed up at my suite. What's it going to take? We'll give her $15,000 worth of free stuff. We'll give her something customized. What's it going to take? Here's a perfect example. I went to the Four Seasons last night to take a look at the suite that's being run by Revlon Cosmetics and Quiat Diamonds. And it's right next to that really elegant bar where A-listers like Liam Neeson like to have a drink after a hard day on the set. And you go inside and it's just wall to wall with rare diamonds, colored diamonds, diamond necklaces, diamond earrings, anything you can think of. And the other whole side of the room was dominated by every stick and drop of Revlon product you can possibly imagine. And Emmy Rossum, who isn't even a presenter or a performer this year, had managed to get in there and get herself a makeover. And while she was in there, she saw a pair of diamond earrings that she liked that was worth $7,500. And the Quiats say that she's a quote-unquote friend of the house, so they gave them to her. Now, remember, she's not even booked to go to the Oscars. So this is the kind of stuff that happens all the time. I think the public is starting to get a lot more sensitive, especially given that a lot of people are working two or three jobs, and they're never going to be able to afford a scrap of what celebrities get. And I think publicists and PR firms and major corporations are going to start to sense that, and they're going to start to pull back a little bit. You're always going to get the big-time gifts. You're always going to get those big-time gift baskets at the Oscars. But the stuff that comes on the side, the gifting in the diamond suites and the gifting from people like Revlon, I wouldn't be surprised if that cut back just at least a little bit. And I think what you're going to see in the next few years is a lot of these gifts either being pared back or being slipped to the celebrities and the press not knowing about it.
Leslie Gornstein writes about pop culture and Hollywood for the Los Angeles Times and is a columnist for E! Online. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.